Dan Horror with your host, the Mighty Griff.
Hey everybody, I'd like to welcome you back once again to More Horror Than Horror. On tonight's episode, I have a very, very special guest with us tonight. A very, very well-desired movie for myself and Tim over the last couple of years. We've always wondered why a movie hasn't come out of this caliber in a while, but now it has. And the writer of that movie is with us tonight, Mr. J.D. Ferguson. And he is the writer of Dark Knight of the Scarecrow. Mr. Ferguson, welcome to the show. It's glad to have you tonight.
Hi. Yeah. Good to be here, Griff.
You know, the first when I first read the news in Horror Hound several months ago, I was quite excited to learn that the movie was being restored. And the only concern that I had at the time was when it was going to see its release, because I know in the past we've had a lot of sought-after titles have been brought up in conversation and in print before and have yet to see the light of day and release. But, you know, our prayers were answered, and the Night of the Scarecrow was released a couple weeks ago thanks to the wonderful people at VCI Entertainment. Chris and those guys do a fantastic job releasing so many underrated films. And the movie, I've seen the movie a couple of times now, and I can't say it's never looked better.
Well, we spent a lot of time on it, Griff. I personally supervised the restoration from the time we located the Panavision neg until the time it was completed and handed to the VCI. It took almost 2 years because we went into extreme detail to really make it look perfect. And anyone who watches it will notice that there is not a mark, a scratch, a speck anywhere on it, and that all the colors and blacks and everything balanced perfectly. We went to, you know, to great lengths and state-of-the-art to do that, plus, you know, refurbishing the sound by doing a new mix with all the latest techniques, including the 5.1, and we really feel that it is state-of-the-art, that we did everything we could possibly do, and I think it does show up. I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, I'd have to agree, you know, 110% on the quality of the picture and the sound, because I have the Key Video version that I found probably 15, close to probably 17 years ago in a video store. It was just in the, you know, it had been rented so many times that, you know, people just kind of stopped renting it, so they threw it over to the discount bin, and I picked it up fairly cheap, and it's been one of my favorite films of all time, and I've been one of my favorite films to the point where I was always afraid to play it because I was afraid that, you know, if the film ever broke, you know, then I would probably lose one of my top 20 films, you know, of all time. And then, like I said, once I had, you know, had been hearing that, it was in the process of being remade that, you know, I was excited again. And I pulled it out and watched it, you know, one final time, knowing that it would never be put back in the VCR once the DVD was released. And I was totally astonished by the quality of the picture, and the sound was just amazing. So, I mean,
well, you know, we have at our disposal now a magnitude difference in technology, and we were able, fortunately, that it was on film, that, you know, we shot it in the very best format that we could, which was Panavision. And when we went back, we were fortunate in that the original camera material was still in pristine condition. That was a big plus for us. But as I have told some of the fans, I said, what you'll see when you buy the show, you'll be able to see it better than it looked the night it was first broadcast.
Right. And it originally aired on CBS back in 81, correct?
That is correct. It was CBS October 24th of 1981.
Okay.
It was the Saturday night movie, and it was their Halloween presentation.
All right. And at the time, you know, from and also from what I've read in past interviews that you've done in print, pretty much, you know, back in 81 when the movie debuted is pretty much the same way that people are going to see it, you know, now when they put it in the VCR. I mean, there's been absolutely nothing cut out of the movie. There actually has been, except for a couple of voice tracks or something, has been added. But anyway, shot for shot, what was shown on air, correct?
It is. We didn't do anything to re-edit the film. All we did was there were some long black segments in between scenes where there had been commercial placement, but those had been pulled up, but no actual picture had been affected. The only change in the movie at all is at the very last sequence is that 1.5 second shot that was added because it had been left out of the original broadcast, and a lot of people didn't quite understand that last moment, but this was put back in to give it the clarity that we had originally intended.
Okay. And also, I know that Larry Drake played Bubba in the film. What was the process of using the different actor to actually play the Scarecrow? Was there a reason? Was there a scheduling problem?
Larry was only inside the Scarecrow outfit at the time that you move in on it and you see his eyes behind it. That's Larry, where he's pleading for his life and so on and so forth. But all of the other times, there was another fellow in there because we couldn't take a chance on, you know, one of our actors being hurt. You know, when they shoot at him and when the squibs go off and all of that, you don't want your talent.
So he basically just did the special effects portions of it.
Yes. Okay. The other fella did the special effects portions.
Okay.
Actually, most of the time in the movie, the Scarecrow is not moving. You know, he's hanging around, as it were.
All right. And, I mean, actually, the whole premise. Now, you had kind of a double meaning to the film, correct? Wasn't there kind of like a?
You're breaking up, Griff, for some reason.
Was there kind of a like a double meaning to the Otis character? I mean, there was like a dark side to him, wasn't there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the character, the persona that he presented to the people in town, covered up this other side of him. Which came out in his bigotry toward this poor soul. And you see that all the time. I mean, right now we're having a huge controversy over bullying in schools. I mean, they're trying to make law. I don't know how they'll do it, but you've probably seen it on the news as recently as yesterday. It was on ABC and CBS about the bullying thing. And it's, you know, it's really the same thing.
Right. Yeah, I was always kind of I actually watched it one again today with my girlfriend's daughter, excuse me. And she was actually, you know, she, to be honest with you, she's I want to say 11 or 12. And I didn't think personally that the film, you know, was that bad, but anyway, She was quite upset, you know, because she watched the opening portion where Bubba was playing, you know, with the young girl, and I explained to her that he had a child mentality and he was mentally retarded and everything. But she almost when the guys cornered him in the cornfield, you know, she was actually distraught. She was asking me questions like, "Are they going to hurt him?" And I was like, "Yeah." I said, "You might want to close your eyes." So she closed her eyes, and she was really, really, you know, considerably upset that, you know, her as a child was, I mean, just within a few minutes of this movie playing, was actually connecting to the character and actually felt sympathy for him. But then I told her, I said, it's kind of a happy movie at the ending. I said, you know, he kind of comes back and he'll get his revenge. And, you know, it's not really a morbid, grotesque kind of way that, you know, we're used to in movies today. But, you know, and then she sat through the rest of it and she watched it. And then once, you know, at the end, of course, where he's comes back after, you know, he takes care of Charles Durning and gives the little girl the flower, you know, she's had this huge smile on her face, you know. And I said, see, I told you it was a good movie and it had a good story to it. And I told you he wasn't going to be gone forever. But it was kind of cool, you know, to see her connect with this movie, kind of like I did when I first seen it. You know, naturally, I wasn't as young as she was when I first seen it. But it still had that power, you know, like it affected me when I first seen it. And it had that same effect on her when she seen it tonight for the first time. But I know.
Right. Well, that was the... I think that's what makes it, Griff, what makes it different from most horror movies, in that it has this substructure of a very powerful emotional side to it, that you care for people and that you hate people and so forth, that, you know, most of them honestly don't have that. It's just a mad killer slashing people until they get him.
Right.
And in this one, it really has a strong morality to it. Plus, what the movie is really about, it's really not about a horror. What it is, the overall emphasis of the movie, I would say, is the triumph of innocent love over death.
Right. And I know my co-host Tim McClaws would probably have some really good questions for you because he's a huge fan. Tim, do you have any questions for JD?
Oh, I'm just listening. I just read the article when it came out with the Horror Hound, and I was real fascinated with the Struthers Martin. I always tried picturing what he would do with the Durning character. I thought that would be just absolutely great.
Well, I think Strother would have given it a kind of an oilier.
Oh yeah, he would have definitely put his touch on it.
It would have been a little trashier with Strother. He was a very, very dear friend of mine, and as I was writing it, you know, I would go over to his place and we'd talk about scenes, and he actually contributed some of the dialogue that's in the movie. It's not a lot, but there is a line here or there that he felt that would be appropriate, and we used them.
Yeah. Yeah, he, not that, I enjoyed Durning. I thought he was great in the part as well. I just always thought it would be fun to see what Struthers could have done with that.
I kind of thought that the whole cast was perfect, and honestly, they don't make, much less TV movies, they don't make movies like this at all anymore.
Yeah.
And the fact that the TV movie in this era, when this was made, was so powerful. We had Trilogy of Terror, we had this, we had Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. There were some really powerful, scary TV movies being made. You can't even get that stuff in theaters now. It was an amazing job, a job well done.
But, you know,
well, I think that what was required back in those days, the studios and the networks really did have very good literary departments, which insisted on good stories. And that's kind of, we saw that ending with, you know, the slasher, the pure slasher plus CGI and all the rest of it kind of took over. And it was like everybody trying to outdo everybody else to see how much gore you could get or how many CGI effects you could get and all of that, replacing really good story. And, you know, there's no getting around it, because when somebody asks you, they don't say, tell me a CGI or tell me a slasher. They say, tell me a story. People always want to know a story. They always want to know the story behind anything.
Right.
And that's what we were required to do back then. You know, there's an urban legend about this film that constantly pops up. And everybody says that the lack of on-screen violence and gore is due to the fact that it was made for television, which is not true. I wrote this thing originally as you see it, and it was originally written to be made into a independent feature, which we were not able to do. But the reason it got made for television was because it did not have a lot of explicit violence in it. And I always felt that you, the viewer, would make a much more horrible scene in your mind if I gave you all the pieces except the splatter.
Right. And that's one thing I brought up before in conversations with Todd is, you know, with a lot of movies today, you know, and it's a guilty pleasure of mine. I'll be the first to admit that I like, you know, a good gore fest every once in a while. But it seems like, you know, in the latter years of films being released, it seems like it's you know, like in the horror genre, I think that a lot of times people think of horror fans as the least common denominator, and they try to dumb down the films, thinking that, you know, those fans can't handle the thought process of a good story, therefore they just give you an hour and a half of extreme gore and, you know, some gratuitous nudity, which, you know, again, I'm not, you know, opposing by any means, but a lot of times I find myself, you know, more on the edge of the seat by a movie that waits for the last 15 or 20 minutes of the film to show you the monster that keeps you in suspense all the way up until the end and kind of drags you along with little bits and pieces of the puzzle, you know, to say.
Well, you know, I'll tell you a great example of a film that scared the heck out of me when I first saw it was Alien.
Right.
And Alien does not show very much at all either, if you think about it, and they do not show you the monster until the very, very end of the movie.
Right, and that's, you know, and I mean, even with, like, Universal's Frankenstein, I mean, a majority of that film was all, you know, shot in the laboratory, and, you know, like, the very last quarter of it was really only set, you know, with where the monster came in, and then it was pretty much, you know, the end of the movie, you know, which... You know, a lot of times studios back then, they didn't have a very, very strong special effects budget or in the case, you know, people like the Universal makeup creator, you know, the makeup and stuff was so costly at the time that, you know, one application was pretty much all they can afford, and they didn't want to waste it. So they waited till the end of the film to present it to the audience. And, you know, so they had to base those movies strongly on story, because, you know, they were limited on the visual aspects of it. But,
well, you know, the other thing, too, there's another factor going on here that I've become aware of, and that is, very simply, gore is easy, story is hard.
Right. And I noticed now, you know, with a lot of the smaller, you know, cable markets and stuff popping up, that they are starting to produce their own TV series is now, and they're kind of starting to make their own films rather than, you know, the studios doing it. Speaking of some of your past works, you had a gentleman by the name of Toby Hooper in one of your films called Windsplitter.
That is correct.
And there was a story during your writing process that I heard that you... And you were writing Dark Knight of the Scarecrow at the same time, or is this, you were trying to do the story of Scarecrow at the same time Hooper was trying to do the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something?
It goes back a little farther than that. After the Windsplitter, Toby had made a very lovely film called Eggshells.
Okay.
And I had made the Windsplitter. We were friends, and he did a part in it. And neither movie was very successful, and we were talking one day after all of this, and we realized we were approaching 30, and we thought that was going to be ancient, man. we felt like we better come up with something that we could do to make our careers, or we weren't going to have a career in the film business. And that was pretty much it. We just came to that conclusion, and he went off, and I went off, and we didn't see each other for quite a while. And independently, he went off and developed Chainsaw, and I went off and developed The Scarecrow. both of us had loved and we used to talk about a lot the great historical Roman epics like Ben-Hur and Quo Vadis. We love those, but that was obviously out of the question for us. So the next greatest love was a horror genre. And, you know, it's history now. Toby did the Great Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And shortly afterwards, you know, I tried to do it as an independent feature, could not. But I was able to get entree to CBS, and they loved it and wanted to do it for Halloween, so we did.
Right. And I noticed after you've done The Scarecrow, Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, you didn't really stop there. It looks like you've written Nightmare on the 13th Floor. You've actually wrote like four episodes of The Twilight Zone.
What happened was that Scarecrow did extremely well for CBS, and they ran it again the next year, and it did well again. So I kind of, for a while, I became their horror guy. You know, I got pigeonholed into that, but right. The next show I did was an adaptation of a John Saul novel called, what was the title of that? Oh, goodness, I'm drawing a blank. All of these things are running together now. I can't remember. But anyhow, after that, then we did Chiller. Wes Craven and I got together, and we did Chiller for CBS. Oh, Cry for the Strangers was the John Saul novel. And then Wes and I did Chiller. And then there was, at NBC, I did the movie called The Covenant. And then I got drafted over to, CBS pulled me over to The Twilight Zone, which was coming back on the air in the mid-80s. And I wrote and directed two of those. And then I did get to do one of my historical dramas, finally. I did, it was, for television, it was called Houston, The Legend of Texas. And on video, it's called Gone to Texas. But it's the whole Texas Revolution as seen through the eyes of Sam Houston. And it was starred Sam Elliott with Catherine Ross and a lot of wonderful people. And then, you know, it continued on to the horror thing. I was back in the horror thing again with The Lake for NBC. And Red Water for Turner. And, you know, I think I've skipped a couple of them, but I can't remember which ones they are. Right.
Going back to your time on The Twilight Zone, did Rod Serling, did he give you carte blanche to do whatever you want, writing and directing-wise?
Well, Rod Serling had passed away some years before The Twilight Zone came back on the air. I was not involved in the first one because I was still a kid when that came on. But this was in the mid-80s. I think Rod died in the mid-70s. But I did work with him on one short film for the United Fund, which I produced and directed, that was done like a Twilight Zone. So I got to know him and work with him and, you know, got to talk to him an awful lot about the techniques of the genre.
Right.
And it was very valuable to me, but he was not, you know, he was not even alive when we did the Return of the Twilight Zone.
Okay. What were the episodes' names that you did?
The first one I did was an adaptation of a Ray Bradbury story.
You've got mail.
Burning Man. I wrote the teleplay from his short story and directed that one. And then I wrote an original one, an Irish piece called The Little People of Killeany Woods. And directed that one also. They had asked me to stay on, but we had gotten the Sam Houston thing underway. So, you know, I had to go and take charge of that. I was executive producer on that. So that required all of my attention. And by the time that was finished, The Twilight Zone, that was the end of The Twilight Zone.
Okay. All right. Well, as you probably know, VCI has graciously sent me a couple of copies of Dark Knight of the Scarecrow to give away to our listeners. And you knowing the film the best, I was going to offer up you the first question if you wanted to throw out a specific question that you'd like to see if our listeners could get. And the first, I guess, first two or three people that get those answers right, I'll send them out a copy of Dark Knight of the Scarecrow. courtesy of the fine folks at VCI Entertainment. And do you have any, in particular, like nasty little tidbit questions that you might like to throw out there?
Questions about Dark Knight of the Scarecrow?
Yeah, something that our fans would have to actually watch the movie in order to get.
Yeah, some trivia.
Let me think here a moment. Yeah, Lane Smith, who played Harless, the guy that falls into the chipper, was on a show that had to do with Superman. And what part did he play?
Okay. So for any of my listeners out there, make sure you listen to the replay many, many times if you guys, you know, haven't got your pen and paper out. But my question for the listener is, Mr. Ferguson had an important part in the film but never actually appeared physically in the film. What part did he play?
That's a good one.
And, Tim, do you have a question for the listeners?
Let's see. Be a good one.
We're gonna have to do it. Dun 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 dun.
I know he throws these quick questions now, at me like
you,
I'm gonna jump
I gave
at
you
it.
A week to prepare for
this. Week. I'm still excited about the fact I'm going down to Texas next weekend and there's a mask waiting for me somewhere down there in a museum. That's our question right there. Where's the hidden mask right in Texas?
I know where it is.
I'm gonna find out hopefully next weekend. I'm gonna GPS it.
Actually, I have another question. I figured Tim had probably dropped the ball on this, so I came up with another one. This one's actually pretty easy. Larry Drake went on to, I guess, I would say, win a couple of Emmys for a character that he played on NBC. It was a crime drama called L.A. Law. And if anybody can give me the name of his character on L.A. Law, that is one. And then also Larry Drake starred in two semi-genre films. You know, one was a straight-up horror film, and I want to say that the other film that he had the starring role in was kind of a horror kind of slash comic book slash sci-fi film. So if anybody...
Plus he plays my favorite Santa Claus of all time.
Well, yeah, that's true too. But so anyway... are you on the circuit now, or have they got you doing the conventions any there, JD?
Oh, my goodness. I'm just resting up from the one I came from. We had a convention in Tulsa this past weekend. Two weekends before that, we did the Spooky Empire down in Orlando, which was huge. And in 2 weeks coming up is the big Horror Hound in Cincinnati. So it's been, you know, one on the heels of the other. And after Horror Hound, I think that's it for a while because we're getting into the holiday season.
Right. Now, are you traveling with anything from the film?
What do you mean?
I mean, are you taking any of the, are you taking the Scarecrow mask or anything with you from the movie or any?
Oh, all of that is being brought by the distributor, VCI. They're bringing all of the posters and, the DVDs, you know, they've got the whole works.
Are they selling the masks? I'd seen a couple pictures of them, and I tried finding some to pick up online.
They will be on, yeah, there's a limited issue of that mask, and they will be on sale in Cincinnati at Horror Hound.
I got to get a third.
And I understand you just authorized a new T-shirt design from our friends at Fright Rags.
That is correct. Yeah, they came up with a really, really nice one.
I know Ben's probably going to kill me, but this won't air until the Saturday after his release date. But I guess that design's being released tomorrow. But I've seen just a small square of it, and I could tell right away from the eyes what it was. So I'm actually really, really anxious to see that design. So.
But, right. Oh, it's terrific. It's terrific. He did a great job on it. You know, he had the other one, which was based on the old artwork.
Right.
I'm proudly wearing it as we speak.
Right. That's been retired.
Right.
And the new one is out.
Yeah, so I highly recommend that any of my listeners go directly to FrightRags.com and buy your new Dark Knight of the Scarecrow T-shirt. I couldn't... You know, very rarely do I, you know, I like to mention people that I have close contact with, people that I know personally, and I believe in their products and stuff that I spend money on, because I don't get anything for free. Just so anybody knows, if you hear me talking about something, I've done it in the past. I've gotten good quality, so I believe in helping them out so they can continue to do the exceptional job that I receive when I purchase something from them. But Ben and those guys at Fright Rags are a number one in my book when it comes to apparel because they're horror fans for one, and they don't just release anything to get it out there to make a buck. I mean, these guys actually sit there and they study the designs that they know that everybody likes. You know, they got that one scene in that one movie that everybody always just goes nuts over, and that's the one that usually makes the shirt. But the quality is top-notch. The printing does not fade, give out, crack, distort, or anything after washing. I washed it right side out and everything, and it still stands up. And, JD, you know, I cannot express enough happiness for you. I'm truly amazed and very, very happy that this movie has finally gotten the attention that it deserves. I think it's way overdue. I think this movie, you know, once, you know, the DVD market exploded when it did, this movie should have been right out in the front with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I think, you know, story-wise, it's an exceptional movie, brilliantly made, beautifully done. I'm glad to see that you guys did go in and restore it, and you guys did, you know, treat it with the care and the respect that you guys, you know, wanted to show for it. Because me as a fan of the film, it just makes me all the more happy to add it to my collection. And I know I'm going to watch it many, many more times to come and probably end up buying a second copy just because I'll probably wear my first copy out. So,
well, it was Griff, it was a labor of love for me because of all the films I did in Hollywood, it's still my favorite. And, you know, I wanted to restore it to the highest level of the state of the art that I possibly could because of my affection for the film. And it was during that time that I found out that how many fans and how many people really loved the movie. So that even inspired me more to want to please them and give them something that was exceptional, not just a good, not just an okay version, but something exceptional that when they sat and watched it, they could sit back and say, my goodness, you can't get much better than that.
Well, I think you succeeded on that. I mean, as far as, you know, I was a kid when I watched it, and it affected me. You know, I thought, man, this is a powerful flick. I mean, that's a thing, though. Like Griff was saying, it's all about quality. And you mentioned earlier, you know, that it's about screenplays and about actual characterization and about a storyline. Now, you know, I'm with Griff in the way that I like a gory flick like the next guy. You know, matter of fact, a lot of my favorite stuff is just absolutely goofy, almost Monty Python in its quotient of bloodletting. But with the films you guys were making, of course, you couldn't do a lot of that on TV. So you had to do a lot of other things just to shock people. And the shock and the scares are there, 100%. And it's quality. Back in the 70s and the 80s, they may have had, or early 80s, they may have had the gore, but they also had good scripts. I mean, that's the thing. Nowadays, first of all, we don't really get good gore, and we certainly don't get good scripts. No. So we miss you. miss you out here.
Are there?
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. A lot of work went into the original screenplay, and when we filmed the movie, the people that worked on it were really dedicated to it. They really wanted to create something exceptional. But at the time, we really felt that, you know, we worked hard on it, but we felt because it was made for television, it was going to come, it was going to show, and it was, you know, it would be gone. We had no idea it was going to achieve the fan base that it has.
Right. And, you know, and it's really a perfect Halloween movie. I mean, even though it doesn't have the atmosphere of a Halloween movie, it's kind of a Halloween movie that, I mean, it's loosely, I want to say, you can actually watch it with children because there is a story there, and there is a learning experience. There's a morality.
There's a morality. It is a morality play.
You know, and
absolutely is a morality play.
And, you know, and it's not, you know, it's like I tell Todd and Tim sometimes, you know, I said it's not about, you know, the killing and stuff in horror films a lot of times, you know. A lot of films, you know, like Frankenstein, for instance, I mean, it's kind of a morality play. I mean, here's a guy who for one, never asked to be created. He just, you know, shows up. And, you know, like everybody else, he just wants to be accepted. He wants to be loved. And yet, everybody kind of is out to get him because of his appearance. You know, he's You know, he's just kind of like, you know, I'm sure a lot of us were in school. You know, we were all different. Some of us were a little bit more awkward than others, but we just wanted to be accepted. We wanted to be liked. And, you know, you had those people out there that were there to try to tear those people down just because they didn't like the way they looked, liked the way they dressed, didn't like a certain type of music they listened to. So there's a lot more than the violence and the gore in horror movies. I mean, there's actually a lot of life put in a horror film. And a lot of people, I think, kind of overlook that because they like to focus on the negative of the horror film rather than the actual, you know, positive that some of the horror films contain. So, And like I said, JD, I can't say it enough, man, but I'm really, really happy that this film has came out. And Chris and those guys at VCI, you know, if anybody's out there listening that has seen the film, you know, stand up and give VCI a round of applause. Give JD a round of applause for doing a tremendous job in the restoration of the film, for saving this film that, you know, the new next generation of horror fans can appreciate it just as much as I did growing up, and they can have it in their collection like I had the beat up key video version. But, you know, I never loaned it out. You know, I had plenty enough, you know, I had friends that say, oh, I'd like to see that. It's like, well, sit down and we'll watch it, but I'm not loaning it out because it's one of those films that I'm not going to be able to find again. So it's not going to go anywhere, you know, too far away. So.
Well, I appreciate all of those good comments, and we worked hard to bring it forward to this generation so that they could appreciate it. And now that we have it in the digital domain, you know, it's captured. And if over a period of time, film does deteriorate.
Right.
And we know that's going to happen, but it's captured now.
Now, are you currently working on any new projects that you'd like to promote tonight?
You know, I wish I could tell you something, but actually I have been, you know, for the last 2 years, I have been completely involved with this in the restoration and now the promotion of it, which actually won't end until after the Horror Hound show in November. So I haven't had a moment really to even give a lot of thought.
Right. Well, doing
anything else?
You know, we have listeners all over the United States, so go ahead and rattle off wherever you're going to be, you know, appearing at, and, you know, we'll have the fans come out and shake your hand and thank you personally for a job well done, if you'd like to.
Well, the only thing left now is the big show in Cincinnati, which is the Horror Hound weekend up there. And it's, you can find it online. Just, you know, look up Horror Hound Weekend, and it'll tell you all the information you need to get there. We will be there. You won't be able to miss us. We are, you know, we'll be in the guest area,
right.
And I'll be signing posters, and we'll, the VCI will be selling the DVDs, and I'll be autographing those if anybody wants it. And that's gonna be it. And after that, I'm gonna take the rest of the year off, what there is left of it.
Right.
And then we'll see next year, you know, what pops up. But if anybody is looking for the film now, I mean, it's all over the place. But probably the easiest place to get it is Amazon. You know,
right. Well,
I've just about gone completely to buying from Amazon because I can get it in 2 days and I don't have to hunt for it.
Right. Well, actually, I come from St. Joseph, Missouri, and in the city that I live in, there's a Hastings. And Hastings does cover the DVD now. And when it was released, a friend of mine had called me and said that he had picked it up. And I asked him how much it was. And I think he said it was $14.99. So I was like, all right, I'll go out there and pick one up when I get off of work. So he came by and picked me up. We went out there, and they were completely sold out. And I said, well, what did they have, like, did they have, like, what, was there two copies? Was there another copy? He said, no. He goes, they had 10 copies. He said they had the whole, there. He said there was two stacks of five beside each other. They were completely gone. I checked the regular, you know, hodgepodge where they have the drama and the comedy and all that mixed up because I figured, you know, maybe they threw them over there. I checked the horror section. They was completely out, and I checked the new release section. And the woman at the counter said that, no, they came in, but they were sold out of them, and they were expecting another shipment in. So,
oh my goodness!
But I mean,
well, I've heard that elsewhere. A couple of my friends went to a convention, and one of the vendors had five of them there. And one of the fellas said, "Yeah, we're going to walk around and take a look at the other stuff. We'll be back. I want to pick one up." And he said, when they came back, they were gone.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So if they're out there, if you see them, I highly recommend that you grab it now, because if you're gonna, you know, haste makes waste. You're going to turn around and go grab a gallon of milk, and you're going to come back, and it's going to be gone, and you'll be kicking yourself in the rear for not picking it up sooner. So those people right, out there.
The only other thing I'll add is there are a couple of, there's not a lot of extra material, but there's some nice stuff. There's the original CBS Saturday Night Movie opening with the original trailer on it. And there's also a 5.1 optional track if you have 5.1, and we went to great lengths to make that 5.1 sound good.
Cool.
So that really helps a lot if, you know, if you're into the 5.1.
All right. Well, JD, it's been fun. It's been a great pleasure talking to you tonight, and I thank you very much for coming on my show and being my first official guest on More Horror Than Horror. We're not going to stay there. We're going to keep in touch with you. We're going to have you back on. We're going to bring this back up. We're going to talk about it some more. We're going to keep promoting it, and we're going to get those people back out after the first year to those conventions, and we're going to have those hands shaking and have the people finally get to meet the people that brought a great film back to life, because you didn't forget us. You kept us, and you gave us what we wanted. So, Mr. Ferguson, I applaud you, sir. You did a tremendous job, and I thank you.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me on your show. And I want to thank all of the fans for their support, because without you guys, we don't exist.
Thank you, sir. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Take care.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we are supposed to show you scenes from the picture Blood Feast, which will be shown as a late show next Saturday night. However, due to the extreme horror of the context of this picture, and due to the fact that this audience has not been forewarned, we will not show this preview. Instead, let us warn you that no children will be admitted during the showing of Blood Feast. In fact, there will be a policeman on duty at the box office to make sure they do not enter the theater. And if you're the least bit squeamish or have a heart condition, we strongly recommend that you not attempt to see this picture. A nurse will be on duty during the showing of the picture too, not as an advertising gimmick, but because she may very well be needed. See the picture if you must, but remember, we warn you.
And we're back.
That was like spectacular.
So what's going on with that chick, the panty chick? She's not doing it no more?
And we're back.
She's doing it? What are you talking about?
Welcome back to More Horror Than Horror. We're back.
Well, every time I try, you guys always start in with your shit.
And we're back.
Okay, so if anybody has any answers to the questions tonight, just go ahead and email them to morehorrorthanhorror@hotmail.com. So, but then I'll get those out to you as soon as I'm just going to go through first five answers that come in. I'm just going to grab stuff and send out to you. But the first two that come in, first place, for second place, will get the Dark Night of the Scarecrow DVDs. Everybody else is going to get either a copy of Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, The Stitcher, or The Rig, starring William Forsythe.
Wow, cool.
And also for this week, October 26th being released DVD-wise, The Carrier from Code Red, Dark Star, the Hyper Drive edition from VCI, Cannibal Girls from Shout Factory, The Green Slime from Warner's Archive Collection. Oh,
Cannibal Girls. That was such a good movie.
Hot, hot Cannibal Girl.
I have that one.
Hard-nippled Cannibal Girl.
I don't know about that one.
House, 1977, the Criterion Collection.
That's a crazy Japanese film. That's pretty cool.
The Living Dead Girls being re-released, I guess, from Redemption.
For the 17th time.
Yeah. The 30th Anniversary Maniac 2-disc from Blue Underground.
Yes. I had that for 2 weeks. I found it early at Best Buy.
Yes, they do have it at Best Buy on Blu-ray.
Blue Underground did a major job on Blu-ray. It's beautiful.
But, and then just a little bit of tidbit of information, something that me and Todd brought up a couple weeks ago. We was talking about the movie Burial Ground with the meathead
with the
zombies in it.
Yeah, little guy talking about sausage finger.
The best part of Burial Ground is the man midget that they have in it.
Mommy.
And we was always discussing... his name is Peter Bark, also pronounced Pietro Barcella, I guess is his Italian pronounced name. But apparently he's only done
sausage fingers. Sausage fingers.
But apparently he's only done four films. His last was in 1983. And everything I think has pretty much been uncredited for some reason why. But anyway, he did a movie called Via Alla Grande.
What happened to him?
I don't know.
It seemed like I read a story about him. It was like on a safari, and they thought well, he was one like a baboon or something.
I didn't go that far into it. I just basically looked up his name because I was watching it. I threw it in, and I always love that part where he comes in and Mommy. Chomps the big hole out of his mom's tit.
Mommy.
But it's kind of comical. But other than that, just your typical fare being released. Another movie you might want to check out is American Grindhouse. It's kind of an odd movie. It's only available on Netflix Instant Watch. It's about 81 minutes in length. I tried to find it on Amazon's only got it as an instant watch. I don't know if they just don't have distribution for it yet.
It's probably there's a few of them that are that way. They're waiting for their DVD debuts, but they're debuting them on this this instant watch stuff. Yeah.
It's narrated by Robert Foster, Jackie Brown, or Robert Forster. I'm sorry, Jackie Brown. It contains interviews with Robert Forster, Joe Dante, Jack Hill, John Landis, Fred Williamson, David Hess, Herschel Gordon Lewis, Jonathan Carlin, Jeremy Kasdan, Bob Miner, Fred Olin Ray, and Louis Tanique. But very entertaining, very educational, and it's got a lot of cool clips. And they actually go through and tell you, you know, the movies that you're watching clips from, so you're not just left there with a dumb look on your face wondering what you're watching.
But except for some people we won't mention.
But that's about it for this episode. We're wrapping it up now. Wish everybody happy holidays. Enjoy yourself.
You're going to say Thanksgiving? Safe. What the hell?
Happy Autumn Fest.
We'd like to wish you happy. And we're back.
Did you know?
Enjoy raking your leaves on Sunday.
Trunk or treat. Has anybody seen these signs?
Went and did it yesterday.
Trunk Jesus. Or treat.
What is that?
Here's what it is.
Welcome back to the show.
And we're back.
It's when midgets.
Apparently a couple of religious institutions across the Kansas City metro area.
No, not religious institutions. My kid's fucking school, man.
I counted two churches that had these signs in front of their churches, and it said trunk or treat.
So everybody gets in the parking lot. Your kids are safe.
How safe are your kids considering that what's been going on with churches lately? That's kind of my question.
Well, this was at my
hello,
kid's
would you like some candy, little guy?
At least my neighbors, I know where to find the son of bitches. I'm giving out caramel candy balls this year. Fuck them.
No, he stole them from the Ewoks. He has plenty.
I got plenty.
Instead of good and plenty, though, it's crap and plenty.
I can get you plenty of caramel balls.
I know them Ewoks. I know where they live.
I can get you by 3 o'clock.
They live on indoor. They may live on indoor, but where do Wookiees live? Come on.
Come on.
Come on. Come on. You guys know all this stuff. Felderkarb. Kashyyyk.
Billy G.
Kashyyyk. Come on, guys.
I'm not Hindu. I don't know stuff like that.
What the hell's the guy?
I'm a Lord of the Rings fan.
Oh, that explains everything.
Whoa.
You're a hairy foot guy.
There ain't a walking tree. That son of a bitch ain't a movie. Take me to the volcano, Mr. Beard.
And they couldn't have 14 endings if that happened. Come on. Now, Griff, I'll let you wrap up your show.
All right, so that's it for this
episode.
And we're back. So if anybody has any questions, comments, or ideas, you can email us at morehorrorthanhorror@hotmail.com, or you can get a hold of me on MySpace at The Mighty Griff, or more horror than horror on Facebook. And
he says horror. I'm telling you, it sounds like horror, doesn't it? He kind of puts those R's together so close. More horror than horror.
They know what it means.
I thought you were talking about Sarah Palin again.
We should call ourselves more Sherry Moon than Sherry Moon.
Oh, why'd you have to go there? Why did you have to go there?
I'm sorry. Rap.
Rap. That's it. Good night. Happy Halloween.
I'm getting
bye.
In Christine, and I'm driving her over. That's it.
Don't eat the cotton balls.
Snake in a paradise, a serpent that's wriggling between us and freezing our feelings to ice. One way this drop of blood we bleed because of this. Something's